if you want to be aggressive and can be very aggressive for a short period of time, the evidence that I read would suggest that it's almost all positive in terms of body composition, meaning fat is lost and muscle is retained.
Welcome to the Wits and Weights podcast. I'm your host, Philip Pape, and this twice-a-week podcast is dedicated to helping you achieve physical self-mastery by getting stronger, optimizing your nutrition, and upgrading your body composition. We'll uncover science-backed strategies for movement, metabolism, muscle, and mindset with a skeptical eye on the fitness industry so you can look and feel your absolute best. Let's dive right in. Wits and Weights community, welcome to another episode of the Wits and Weights podcast. Back on the show today is Dr. Bill Campbell, director of the Performance and Physique Enhancement Lab at USF. And he was on the show back in episode 92, where we discussed all of his findings on improving body composition through food selection, fat loss, training, diet breaks, you name it. And I invited him back on the show to revisit the latest in rapid fat loss, a very hot topic we'd love to talk about, including the practical findings from the challenge that we ran, the Wits and Weights Shredtober Challenge back in 2023, where we followed a protocol inspired by his research. So we'll discuss some other topics from his Body by Science review, like progressive versus aggressive calorie deficits. When does optimal bulking become dirty bulking? The effects of a keto diet on muscle building, and a new study that Bill's research lab is currently planning. I don't even know what it is, so it's going to be a surprise to me when we get to that. So I didn't ask ahead of time because I wanted to be surprised. So stick around to the end of the conversation if you want to find out more about that. In addition to his academic work, Bill publishes the Body by Science monthly research review. I think you're at 20 issues now and counting, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah, 20. And I've read every single one, and they cover a lot of topics, a few of which we are going to talk about here. In that review, you don't just get the studies and their limitations, but also guidance from two experts in the industry related to that study that you can apply to your life. Dr. Campbell has also started holding some live trainings for subscribers, including recent ones that I've enjoyed on anti-obesity drugs, energy balance, and fat loss. So, Bill, welcome back to the show.
Yes, happy to be back.
All right. So we want to start with rapid fat loss, everyone's favorite topic. And we can definitely get to your latest research and latest findings, but if you don't mind, we'll set the context with the personal experiment that I ran. We had members of the community run it. Out of 12 people who signed up, 7 got through it, which is pretty good. And I sent you a white paper, and you were gracious enough to take a look and review and give me some feedback. So for the listener, just real high-level summary of what it was. It was a 14-day protocol, 4 days in a 45% deficit, 1 refeed, where we brought the carbs back up so the calories equated the maintenance calories, then 4 days in a deficit, 1 day refeed, 4 days in a deficit. So pretty straightforward. Target macros were 1 gram per pound of body weight for protein, around 25% for fat from calories. It varied by person, and the remainder for carbs. And we tracked a bunch of details. I personally lost about 3.6 pounds of fat and minimal muscle, you know, as best as I could measure that. And then the average for volunteers was 3 pounds scale weight, 1.5 inch on the waist, and expenditure dropped by maybe 100 to 200 calories. A lot of people really liked the simplicity of the diet and how short it was, despite it being aggressive. So the conclusion that I had was it was effective to quickly shed fat while preserving muscle and kind of psychologically get through it. But I did identify some other limitations, like would higher protein have helped? Would more satiating foods help? Would more, you know, properly using the refeeds and sleep and all this other stuff? Okay, so that's the context for the study, Bill. I'll stop talking and ask you, like, what are your overall thoughts? We can get into any surprises that you saw, maybe not, whether you thought it was successful, and then we can talk about some of the details of the protocol.
Yeah, my first thought was I love that you actually took the idea and then implemented it, because we don't have much research on this. I think last time we talked, I did a rapid fat loss study that was a 14-day study, and then I reviewed an extreme fat loss or rapid fat loss study in my research review that was only like 4 days or 7 days, depending on how you want to look at it. So I'm very appreciative of people like you that know physiology, that you kind of like you mapped it out as your own personal experiment. I remember you sending me like the methods and everything. I'm like, this is great. So loved the fact that this was a, yeah, it wasn't something that you're going to publish, but it was an experiment. So that's when you can feel a lot better about, okay, well, now we have actual data. And then I guess you were able to recruit some highly motivated people to undergo this. So first, just the fact that you could execute on it and get other people, I applaud you for that. And then my impressions after looking at the white paper that you wrote was, it was, I guess I was, I don't know about happy, but I was like, okay, this is good. This is what I would expect. And what I would expect was, since it was short, 12 days of a pretty aggressive diet out of 14, almost all of the weight loss appeared to be from body fat stores. So that's exactly what we want. And I don't know how much we got into this last time, but I used to, my former opinion was avoid this type of dieting. And now I have to kind of contextualize that. And I say, you should avoid this aggressive dieting for extended periods of time. So that's the caveat, because there's too much research now. And even in application like you and your group, if you want to be aggressive and can be very aggressive for a short period of time, the evidence that I read would suggest that it's almost all positive in terms of body composition, meaning fat is lost and muscle is retained. So those are my general thoughts.
Yeah, no, it's one of the biggest surprises from individuals running it was they were worried that it would be just disastrous, like, you know, from a mental standpoint, or you wouldn't be able to quote unquote stick with it. But because of the high protein, you know, they were fairly full early on. It wasn't a big deal. The refeeds created these nice little moments of relief. And then it was short. So that's the key. Now, when people reach out and they say, how much weight can I lose on that? I say, you're going to lose exactly the amount of weight that the deficit suggests you're going to lose. Like, that's my answer. Do you agree with that? Like, is there any, there's no magic to this, or is there any tweak you would make, like even higher protein, you know, 1.5 grams per pound or something to induce any better outcome of this diet?
No, my only consideration would be, and I don't know how the group of people that you got to follow it, if are they typically eating pretty high protein? I know a general, what I call general population person, they may struggle getting that much protein. Mm-hmm. So I would have a little concern that it might be too much. Now, I'm always the more the better when dieting. That is my philosophy. And it's particularly with this, when you're reducing calories by nearly 50%, we want almost all those calories to come from protein. Mm-hmm. But bodybuilders wouldn't struggle with that. They're used to that. But I've found that people that are more new, that don't appreciate what protein does in terms of its benefits for fat loss, for muscle gain. And like you said, it helps control hunger. It's just a big ask to ask somebody to get that much protein. But in this case, well, let me ask you, did any of your participants have any problems? And where would you rank them in terms of, they're pretty experienced dieters, they've been resistance training for a while. How would you describe them?
Yeah, I naturally biased the study to join the study, as you have to already be lifting and tracking your food. So it filtered that out. I did have a few closer to newbies who were just, you know, very committed and made it happen. And then when I took the results, you know, some people did drop out. So we were left with the 7 who stuck through it. And I separated it into a high adherence, like a full adherence and not full adherence. And the full adherence group was 98.7% on their protein. The all group was still 96%. So that's close enough. You know what I
Very
mean?
Very close. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Close enough. So that's what I found. But I agree. Like, the big caveat whenever I bring this up is, this is not a crash diet. This isn't just somebody who's like, oh, I got to lose weight. I've never done any of this stuff before. Give me your protocol and let me run it. Like, that to me, that's a dangerous approach. It's an advanced approach. It sounds like you agree, right, with that?
Yes. Yeah. And the thing is, when you have, I don't want to call them normal people, but when you have people who aren't fit, and when they try this, they don't know, and they don't care about protein. They don't care about doing any type of exercise. So they're really setting themselves up for ultimately having more body fat on their body, because you have to maintain your muscle. That's the key. So in the wrong hands, this strategy is foolish and more harmful than good. In the right hands, or with the right education and mindset, it can be helpful. And two things on that note. One, I like the idea of being really aggressive at the start of a diet, because that's when everybody's most motivated. after you've been doing this for, you know, 14 days, you're kind of probably somewhat beat down. And to ask somebody to continue is a big ask. So I like to use the language of, let's leverage your high motivation to diet more aggressively in the first week or two, and we can get a bigger body composition success in terms of losing body fat. The other thing is, since I've been into this research literature, there's multiple studies that show that it actually is a better outcome. And most of this literature is in people with obesity. But if they have early fat loss success, and let's just define that as the more aggressive they are early, the greater the long-term weight loss is. And that's what we're trying to do, trying to get long-term weight loss. And along with that, this is where the health benefits come in. If somebody is overweight and starting this and tries this very aggressive approach, well, then we have all kinds of health markers like triglyceride or lipid panels, metabolic health, fasting insulin, like all those other benefits, according to the evidence, are also happening along with fat loss.
Yeah, for sure. I love that approach. And I would add to that, someone who has excessive weight to lose will probably experience some body recomp potentially, even when they're dieting, because they have the brand new muscle stimulus from training that they're just starting. That's one benefit. The other thing with the aggressive start is your metabolism is at its highest because it hasn't gone through the adaptations it's about to experience through your dieting phase. So why would you take like the inverse approach and go take it easy and then later on try to go more aggressive when the calories are even lower? You know, I just started my own fat loss phase this week, you know, and I'm in that first week you always have where it's just this major change and, you know, the lack of energy is showing, but I have a lot of calories to work with. So I'm taking advantage of a huge deficit early. I think it's a good approach.
Yep.
Okay, training. We didn't get into the nuances of it last time. Based on the study so far or your current work, is there like an optimal type of program you would put someone through during a rapid fat loss phase? Or is it more the principles of, hey, as long as the progressive overload and the tension's there, the stimulus, you're fine? Tell me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot, and later on I can tell you about some research that we're planning. And as I look at this, let's just call it the concept of rapid fat loss or aggressive fat loss, I'm trying to think through different dieting lengths and what each length would need to have in it. So on one hand, let's just say the shortest amount of time would be 7 days. So I have in my head, nothing on paper yet, but a 7-day plan, then a 14-day plan, which is what you did. And then I would say there's also a 28-day plan. So the longer and longer if the philosophy that one has to embrace, if you're going to do this, is you are prioritizing fat loss. This is, let's not pretend you're going to gain muscle. You're not. Mm-hmm. Let's also appreciate that by doing this, you could lose some lean tissue. Hopefully not. We're going to try to do everything we can to maintain it. But we are saying, you know, what if we put effort into fat loss, then we may lose some lean tissue. And I also want to say, when we lose muscle when dieting, it's not gone forever. We get that back pretty quick when the caloric deficit is over. So that's also, some people think, oh, I'm damaged for life. No, not really. Just it's a short term setback. So as we look at this 7, 14, and 28 day, the longer the intervention goes, the more and more emphasis I'm going to put on a resistance training stimulus, because that's the longer a caloric deficit lasts and the greater the likelihood of losing lean tissue. So now let me go to the 7-day, what I'll call the extreme approach. I would not even have resistance exercise in that strategy, in that 7-day plan. And I'll explain why. And again, this is all theoretical, but borrowed from a published study in males with obesity, where they put them on a 4-day extreme diet. It was a 320 calorie diet. All those calories came from protein. And it was 4 days and then 3 days of going back to their pre-diet maintenance calories, which again is what you did for your 2 refeed days. And that study, again, now these weren't resistance trained people, but I'm going to borrow from them. 4 days of this 70-75% caloric deficit. It was, they lost all body fat loss. They didn't lose lean tissue. And even water was accounted for after the 7 days of refeeding. So we keep, we even have that addressed, that, you know, how much of that was water, et cetera. And my thinking is, if we look at the two tissues, fat tissue and lean tissue, fat tissue is much more responsive acutely. Lean tissue is not. So yes, those subjects didn't lose lean tissue. And that's because I think the intervention wasn't long enough. If you continue eating 320 calories, you're going to lose lean tissue. But it's almost like you, with this approach, go in hard, go in aggressive, and then get out. And you get the body fat adaptive response, the loss, but it wasn't long enough to cause a downregulation or an actual loss of lean tissue. Now, let's forward that to kind of a model that you did, a 14-day. Now, I think that is a long period. Now, you're not going to give somebody 320 calories. You're going to give them more calories, but still be aggressive. Now, we need to have a greater stimulus for anabolism so that we don't lose muscle. So that may look like, you know, 3 days per week, 4 days per week, whatever that is. Again, this is all theoretical. But now we're going to have that as part of the plan. And then also with the 28-day plan, we're also going to make sure that there's a resistance training stimulus. So in your group, did you tell people continue to doing what they were normally doing, or how did you manipulate?
Yeah, I did. I said continue training, but if not, I think I suggested you had to already be training when you started. But there were a few that were like, I want to just start training. Can I jump in? And I'm like, you could try, you know, see what happens. But I suggested some very basic, like big lifts 3 days a week, full body type stuff. You know, just keep the intensity high, the load high, not too much volume to manage recovery. So that's what we did.
Yep. Okay. Awesome.
Now, so on the most aggressive one, you said no resistance training is part of the plan. Are you recommending to abstain from the training because of recovery issues or whatnot, or just it doesn't matter?
Yeah. So in that study, again, not really, this hasn't been done in resistance trained people. And I'm going to talk about what I have planned. I'm going to do this in females, at least that's the plan. But a 7 day extreme fat loss or rapid fat loss plan would mean, hey, we are doing this because we want to lose body fat. That is the overarching, the primary goal. So part of this plan is, at least in the research study that's been published, 8 hours per day of walking plus 45 minutes per day of upper body cycling exercise or ergometer exercise with your arms. So your arms are like making pedaling motion on an arm ergometer. So in that case, not only are calories at 320, but the very low intensity physical activity, the volume is very high. Again, 8 hours in this published study. So at some point, we wanted to target fat loss. And if I were to say, even if you're resistance trained, let's also do a workout. Well, now we're not maximizing what we agreed was the primary goal, which was fat loss. Now, again, at some point, whether it's 10 days, 11 days, I'm not going to have that same philosophy. We do want a resistance training stimulus, but we're going to be so aggressive in this 7 day study or this 7 day plan. And by the way, the 7 day plan, it's only 4 days of dieting and walking. The last 3 days are rest and bringing calories back up. So we recover from that. Because again, if we did that for 7 days, I think, well, we're probably going to lose muscle mass. Then they're going to have extreme hunger afterwards, and they're going to gain body fat back. So it's very targeted, precise on the number of days, and the lower body, the walking as the exercise, is very high volume. And I think throwing in resistance exercise is not going to accomplish anything positive for the overriding goal.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that sounds very aggressive and a lot of work, but it's short. It's extremely short.
Yeah.
I did some quick math on my end. Like, I'm probably at a higher metabolism than an untrained person, but even if I were to dock it down a little, it would result in like 700 calories for me, 600 or 700 calories, and I'd probably lose 2.5 pounds or almost 3 pounds in those 4 days. Just to put the numbers in perspective, I don't know if that's similar to what you're seeing, is like, pound wise, it's probably like 2 to 4 pounds, right? Is what we're saying? Or could it be more? Well, I guess you're heavier.
Yeah. In the study that I'm relying on, in these males with obesity, they lost 5% of their body weight. So if they were 200 pounds, well, that's 10 pounds
okay.
over this 7 days. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, you know, I'm always thinking ahead, yeah, but they didn't keep that weight off. They did. They measured, they went, again, after 4 days, they went 3 days later. So 7 days later, they still maintained their weight. Then they went a month out. They gained a little bit of that weight back, but it was still, they still had maintained almost all of that weight loss. And then they even did it a year out. They said, hey, where are these people at a year out? And they still had significant weight loss from where they started. So that's where the health benefits of this approach, mm-hmm. again, in the right hands with the right perspective, can be an overall health benefit by losing this excess fat. Because that's another thing we have to appreciate. Excess adiposity is not healthy. So we're trying to address that first and foremost. And in that study, again, lipid panel increased, fasting glucose, all of the there are multiple markers were significantly improved and they were maintained. Now, again, I'm thinking before I read that study, if you told me, yeah, this is what people did, and then they followed up a month later, I'm like, they gained all that weight back.
Mm-hmm, sure.
They didn't. And it was, and again, it was very targeted and precise. So that's what's guiding me. And I'm going to, again, I'm designing a similar study around this principle.
All right, we're going to keep teasing people on that.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. We're very close to submitting the IRB for that study. So yeah, we're working on three studies right now, so we can talk about all of them.
Okay. Well, the one that you specifically teased me about that you wanted to talk about, is that that one or is it a different study?
No, it's the rapid fat loss.
Okay. We can just segue into it and then get to the other topics so we don't jump around. Yeah.
All right. So what we're doing is, so I kind of have two interests. So my first interest comes from my wife. She had a very difficult time through menopause. And my wife is somebody who's been fit her whole life, exercises, you know, tracks her macros, eats high protein. And she basically hit a wall. And being married to a fat loss researcher, I would often do, you know, experiments on my wife, test her on this, have her do this type of diet, monitor this. And for the first time in her adult life since we've been married, she was non-responsive to a caloric deficit. And I was like, wow, this is challenging me because this shouldn't happen. So I just mentioned that because I want to start investigating and reading a lot of the research in this aging female population. It sounds horrible. My wife would say, I'm not aging, but whatever. I'm gonna call it aging, the aging female population in their 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. So having that interest, and then also the interest of just this rapid fat loss, we're going to do what's called a case series study, which means we get a handful of women, you know, 6, 8, 10, I think we're looking at 8, and we're going to put them on a very aggressive rapid fat loss for 7 days. What I'm going to do is have two women that are premenopausal. We're going to have them eat, let's just say, you know, a couple hundred calories. I think we're going to do 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight or 0.75 grams per pound. And they're going to walk 6 hours per day for 4 days. So very low calories, as much or almost all calories coming from protein, a 6 hour walking event. And we're going to do blood work, body composition, body water, metabolic rates. We're going to do all of the tests. And two women are premenopausal. Two women are in menopause, meaning that, you know, they're currently in the rough spot for some females that experience this. And then four females that are clearly postmenopausal. Two of those four are on HRT of some type, and two are not on any type of HRT. So it just gives us an idea. Again, it's not a full-blown study. It's gonna, you got to be careful about conclusions you're going to make, but it's going to be the start of an area or a category of my future research interests. And I'm excited about this. And I also want to make sure I give credit to my my research coordinator for this is Landon Shanahan. She's one of my master students, and she's going to lead this project for me.
That's awesome. Yeah, I bet there's a lot of women listening who their interest got piqued because this is, it's a very hot area today, right? Perimenopause and postmenopause for women because of, like you said, there's things that we guys can't directly identify or empathize with necessarily with the hormonal milieu, right? Changing so much at that time. And 40s and 50s is kind of that time frame. So I love how you're segmenting into all these different pieces. The 200 calories, I mean, you're almost fasting, but it's protein. It's all protein, like you said. So 0.75 grams per pound. And do you care about the starting weight being in a certain range for your subjects?
Yeah. So what we have so far is my team and I are discussing this. They have to be resistance trained. So people that currently exercise, we will put an exclusion criteria if they're too lean because there's no body fat to lose in that case. So probably the only exclusion criteria would be if they're like stage lean to start. And I'm just going to predict those will be a lot of the females that would want to do the study.
I would go from 10 to 9 or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man. And then the 6 hours of walking, what does that look like? Is this controlled on a treadmill?
No, it could be depending on the weather. So we're starting with the idea that we're going to do this on campus. So any female would have to live in the Tampa area. And ideally, I mean, it could be outdoors or it could be on an indoor track, or it could even be on a treadmill. And what we want is I hate overcomplicating things. I like things to be practical. So we're going to, the instructions are, you walk at a comfortable pace. So we don't want them hurrying. We don't want them barely moving. Just, hey, how would you normally walk? And we're going to also do heart rate monitor, pedometer. So we're going to get data on this. But I would like, if this seems like it would be helpful to recommend to certain people, I just want them to say, okay, I got to walk for 6 hours. Now, does that have to be consecutive? Just over the 24 hours, a six-hour cumulative intentional walk. So we're not counting like, I need to go to the grocery store. No, purposeful walking. And I imagine if I were going to do, which I am going to do this, I'm going to pilot this. I would imagine like I would probably do it in 2 hour segments. So 2 hours in the morning, another 2 hours right before lunch, and then 2 hours in the late afternoon. If I had to guess. And remember the male study, they did 8 hours of this. Yeah.
That's a
plus 45 minutes of arm ergometry exercise.
So yeah, I'd have to have a lot of podcasts and Netflix and everything ready to go. My standing desk and all that.
Yeah.
My name is Tony. I'm a strength lifter in my 40s. Thank you to Phil and his Wits and Weights community for helping me learn more about nutrition and how to implement better ideas into my strength training. Phil has a very, very good understanding of macros and chemical compounds and hormones and all that. And he's continuously learning. That's what I like about Phil. He's got a great sense of humor. He's very relaxed, very easy to talk to. One of the greatest things about Phil, in my view, is that he practices what he preaches. He also works out with barbells. He trains heavy, not as heavy as me, but he trains heavy. So if you talk with him about getting in better shape, eating better, he's probably going to give you some good advice. And I would strongly recommend you talk with him and he'll help you out. Thanks.
So, okay, a couple other questions come to mind then. One is, do you do a pre-diet phase to measure their metabolic rate accurately?
So we're going to have them track their calories for, I think, up to 2 weeks prior. Also track their body weight so we can estimate what their maintenance calories are. And then we also will measure their metabolic rate. So we'll have all that data. Now, the reality is that's good data to have, but because we're saying we just want you to get 1.6 grams per kg of protein and as little other additional fat and carbs. So sometimes something comes along with protein. We're not looking at as much of a caloric deficit. This is what most people would call a protein sparing modified fast.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's essentially what it is. And again, we haven't submitted this yet. So I'm glad you're asking questions because I didn't even think of the cumulative or does it have to be all at one time or can they split it up? Like that's something I just had in my mind. But when you do research, we need to put that stuff out there.
Yeah, because my head is, it's kind of like when you first learn a training and you learn plate math and it's just in your head all the time, I have like expenditure math in my head all the time because I think in terms, I know you and a lot of the research talks in terms of like percent deficits and stuff like that. And I think in terms of like percent rate per week, so it's more relative to your expenditure and your body weight. And so when I hear like the term, like when you said a non-responsive to a calorie deficit, right? I challenge that language a little bit. And, you know, I did that by email to you with one of your live trainings, because to me, if you actually are in the calorie deficit, it will work. It's just that what you're saying is the attempt to be in a deficit resulted in you not being in a deficit.
Yes. Or it becomes so untenable for a, let's just say for a female. Yeah. Let's go to 600 calories. Good. There you go. There's your life.
Exactly.
It's not really what, you know, right. Nobody wants to do that. Yeah, nobody wants to wreck. Well, I don't want to recommend that. But yes, I mean, maybe in reality, hey, that's what, if you want to lose fat, you're struggling, that's what you need to do. Or is there other things in play? And again, I'm admitting I have a lot to learn in that population. But man, I'm telling you, as soon as my semester's over, May 7th, I'm in. I'm already getting the stack of articles that I'm going to pour through this summer.
That's going to be awesome. Yeah, no, and coaches like us who work with those women, feel free to reach out, because man, you know, I see the strangest things. You know, I call it strange. It's just that there's some other variable at play, and it could be, you know, thyroid function and hormone imbalances. It could be the change in their behavior with life stress and everything else. You know, there's a million things that come into play, and it sounds like what you're doing with this study is you're like, let's just shoot way down under that threshold with the 200 calories, just really drop it and see if that responsiveness occurs. And if it differs based on your menopausal status, which sounds like what you're trying to get at, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And maybe we recruit women, the two women in menopause that are perimenopausal, like, hey, we want to recruit women who are not responsive. So like you're saying, like you're telling me you can't. What if we have to be this extreme? Okay, yeah, well, I lost fat, but you lost a lot less fat than the two women that are, you know, early 40s that are premenopausal, or maybe they lose just as much fat. And then that's a narrative that a lot of people don't want to hear. Like, hey, when it's very well controlled, fat was lost. So that's a potential here, but I'm just excited to learn and then to obviously publish this and share it.
Yeah, no, I am as well. Is there anything else you want to say about that? Cause I think you gave us a lot of the details.
Yeah, I think that's the extent of where we're at. And again, hopefully submitting that soon so we can start collecting data in April.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, we'll look out for that for sure. And I'm sure eventually you'll be in your Body by Science in some way. Get that in there.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So we have some other kind of related topics here. The next one is from your issue 12, study 1. And it was on the progressive versus aggressive/consistent calorie deficit. The title for folks listening is Efficacy of Progressive versus Severe Energy Restriction on Body Composition and Strength in Concurrent Trained Women, Vargas Molina et al. From last year, 2023. And just to summarize, the study compared two strategies for restricting calories, right, over 8 weeks. And to clarify, because it gets confusing, constant aggressive, my understanding is the intake was 25 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass. So that's where it gets confusing people listening, because we don't usually think in terms of relative to fat-free mass, right?
Yep.
So 25 calories. The progressive moderate started higher at 40 calories per kilogram fat-free mass and then progressively dropped to 25. Both groups consumed a similar number of calories, but I know there's a caveat because the progressive group didn't reduce their calories as much by the end of the study. And then they both lost similar amounts of body fat and lean mass, and no differences in strength. What I find interesting before I even ask the question is it seems the opposite of what you were talking about earlier, of starting more aggressive, right?
Yes.
This is starting less aggressive and then getting more aggressive. So tell us about that study. And then maybe even like, is there a scenario that fits this? What are your thoughts on that?
Yes. And I think there is a scenario that fits this, and it is exactly the opposite of where I believe is the ideal. Again, somebody says, I want to lose body fat. Then I'm going to say, okay, again, this pretending I'm putting my coach hat on here for a moment. You want to lose body weight. So you're motivated. How motivated are you? Let me suggest that we be more aggressive, or as aggressive as you're willing to be this first week or two. because your body's going to be most responsive, and let's take advantage of your motivation. This study did the opposite, so to speak. It said, let's start very, very, you know, just let's just dip our toe into the water, have a very limited caloric deficit, and then make it greater and greater and greater as time goes on. And what I've come to learn is, even though I'm gravitating towards this, let's punch you in the mouth, figuratively speaking, let's get into a deficit and get, you know, and then come out of it. While that's appealing to me, some people want no part of that. They would much rather, let me start slowly. Okay, this is not ruining my life. Let's go a little bit more. So the one thing I love about this study was it provides an option and some evidence that it's just as effective as a, you know, let's just go on a diet and stay there, or you can ease into it. And again, borrowing from other research where I like being more aggressive early. So it's all about the coach-client relationship and getting to know your client and what they prefer. That was my big takeaway from that study.
For sure. So it's interesting you mentioned that some people would prefer that to get their feet wet. I wonder if we identify the buckets that those people fall into. And where I'm going with that is, like, when I work with a client, they want fat loss. We don't do it from day one, right? We spend some time pre-diet to get everything in order, their training, their protein, their habits, get all the mental demons out as much as possible, create that positive self-identity, right? And then we go after it, in which case the aggressiveness maybe is more palatable versus someone who's just like, I've never done this before, I'm just going to jump in. That's kind of one bucket, but I suspect there is another bucket, like you said, that's different than you and me, that just naturally in any scenario wants to take it slowly first and see if it's working. Do you agree? Or like, is there anything else I'm missing?
And I'll speak with confidence. I know there's people that want to do the slower initial because I communicate with them. Like I have a lot of conversations with people. It's kind of how I keep myself informed for research. There are people, most of these happen to be women that I communicate with, like, yeah, I want to start slow and then get, you know, kind of into this mindset. And if you were going to tell me tomorrow I have to cut my calories in half, like it would just give me a ton of anxiety. But if it's only 10%, now again, I don't think that's, personally, I would never want to do that. But I'm not a psychologist, but I know enough. What you're motivated to do, you're going to do best. So what, that's why I have to ask you these questions, and then we're going to come up with a plan that you will most adhere to for you to get the most success. So yeah, that study is not how I would design a weight loss program.
I totally understand what you mean, because I'll usually map it out on a graph visually for someone and say, look, here are the three kind of glide paths that you get based on the aggressiveness. So you could make the trade-off, you know, if you're psychologically, you want to take it slow, just know it's going to take longer, right? Just by definition, it's going to take longer. Maybe, like you said, in this study, you actually ramp up the aggressiveness, and that's kind of a way to shorten the duration. What about the phenomenon in here where the progressive group didn't quite get to the level that was intended with the calories? Is that a big deal? Because it didn't seem like a big difference, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and this is where I'm speaking outside my expertise. I'm thinking, you're already dieting, and it's a lot of people struggle with just reduced calories. And then you look ahead, oh, I got to reduce some more next week and more next week. It's like, where's the light? There is no light with that. Or it's not way into the future. So that could have been, hey, this approach just does, you know, it has a limitation, and that's one of them. Which, by the way, let me just turn this around. When you start aggressive, and I mean real aggressive, kind of like what we've been talking about so far, and then like the next week, you're going to increase the calories. So you're doing the opposite of what this study did. You're like, oh, I get all these extra calories. But it's still, depending on the, you know, the outlay of the diet, it could be a pretty large caloric deficit. But your perception is, compared to what I just did last week, and whatever that psychology is, I love that. Like, I'm looking forward to these greater calories.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing with refeeds and diet breaks. I mean, yes. The client says, look, I'm going on vacation, I'm going on a cruise. Should I? And I'm like, let's stop right there. Chances are plan A is just you don't even need to track. You could if you want. It's fine. But just go back to maintenance. All you're going to do is suspend it for a week and you're going to have a blast on your cruise. Like, that's the goal of life. Enjoy your life.
Since you mentioned cruises, just when I was younger, many years ago, I used to be a personal trainer and I did this full time. And I used to work in country clubs where a lot of people would go on cruises. And I'll never forget a lot of these, more than a few times, these people that I knew, they would do a lot of the aggressive chronic dieting to get in shape for their cruise. Oh, when they came back, I'm more than one time, it was a significant amount of weight gain. So they did everything wrong. They starved themselves and then were on an environment where they had unlimited access to food and probably not a lot of physical activity. So anyway, whenever somebody and you mentioned, hey, I'm going on a cruise and diet, I'm like, okay, let me.
Yeah, no, not at all. We might even like gradually get them up toward maintenance before the cruise, just so they get used to being there and it's not this binge fest.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So yeah, let's go to the next topic because I'm really excited about this. A few questions came up in my head recently that I wanted to ask you. This is about dirty bulking. Okay. Issue 18, study 1. And this is about like, what's the limit for optimizing muscle gain versus fat gain? There's been a lot of talk about this recently. I've talked about the Helms study that we're dealing with here as well. Eric Trexler and others have been on podcasts constantly talking about it, as I'm sure you have. So the study is, quote, effect of small and large energy surpluses on strength, muscle, and skin fold thicknesses in resistance trained individuals, a parallel groups design. And they compared 10, 20, and 30% surpluses above maintenance for building muscle and gaining strength. So both measures. And they found that basically the 10% seemed to be optimal, beyond which you gained more fat and no more muscle beyond that. And it agrees kind of with the, if you put it in percent rate terms, like 0.2 to 0.3% body weight a week is roughly the same thing. That's again, the way I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, people use different terms like clean bulk, lean gain, dirty bulk, whatnot. I definitely want to ask you just about the general recommendation if people haven't heard this before, and then the pros and cons of for different goals. But then I want to get into some other questions. So what are your thoughts in general? Like 10%, do we think this is a very definitive finding here and agrees with all the other evidence so far?
Yeah, my general interpretation of all the research would be that number, 10%. Now, real quick, that's not based on a lot of studies, but based on the studies that we have, as soon as you go above a 10% caloric surplus, so that's eating 10% more calories than you currently do where you're maintaining your weight, what that study reported and a few others that are, and again, we're talking a handful of studies, what happens is after 10%, you're maximizing your body's ability to increase lean mass, and above 10%, that's capped. You're not building on more muscle, but any additional weight gain is now body fat. So anything above 10% is no more benefit to lean mass, muscle hypertrophy, and piling on, which I can use those terms because that's what the other research would say, piling on excess body fat. And that 10% seems to be the range. And let me also say this, that study, a lot of people misinterpret that because even the abstract said we put people on a 5%, a 10%, and a 15% surplus. That's not what they did. That's what they prescribed. But what the subjects did approximately was what you said. It was approximately 10%, 20%, and 30%. It was like 7%, 18%, and 28%. I'm just going to say 10, 20, 30 to make it easy. But a lot of people were like, they look at what they was prescribed and they're like, oh, 15%. No, it wasn't. It was 30. It was almost 30%. So when you read that study, if anybody's going to read it, don't look at what the researchers prescribed. Look at what the subjects actually ate, what their actual caloric intake was reported as.
And I wonder if that was just a consequence of you're given a target, you're trying to bulk, so you're going to go a little bit over that target on a regular basis. Because that's the way I think when I'm bulking, I don't want to be under, you know?
Yeah, you might as well go all in, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay, so a few things come to mind. One thing people get confused about is there's this asymmetry between losing and gaining, where when you lose, if you're training, right, the goal here is to maintain like 99% of your muscle mass and lose predominantly fat, right? So it's like a, let's say, even if you're not that successful, 95-5 ratio of fat to muscle loss when you lose. But when you gain, there's this limit of, you know, you're like in the 50-50 range or the 1-3, you know, 2-3 range or whatever, depending on your training age. And so you can't just like, from what I've seen, I don't know if you agree or not, the 3,500 calorie rule applies to fat loss very easily, but not, there's, it doesn't apply mathematically to muscle gain, it seems. You have to go lower than that, like more conservative to gain. Like, have you explored that topic or talked about it much?
Well, yeah, I know the math. So a pound of fat is equivalent to 3,500 calories. A pound of muscle, lean mass, is like 550 calories. So if somebody were to say, hey, 3,500 calories, I'm going to gain a pound of muscle. No, I mean, if you were going to convert all of that to muscle, you would gain 6 pounds, about, you know, approximately 6 pounds of muscle. Mm-hmm. But the body, as we all know, the body is slow to build muscle. So if you're going to overeat 3,500 calories, say a week, you can rest assured that that's not all going to lean tissue accretion.
Yeah, and that's a great way to put it. The ratio that you just said of like the 550 to 4,100 of the total, right, when you add muscle and fat, is what roughly would you'd gain. Of course, it again depends on your individual response as well. The second thing about this is there's this adage, right? Mass moves mass. And there's truth there. I sent you a message earlier on Instagram, I think, like that I was going to bring this up, but I don't know if you saw it, but it's okay. The concept is that, you know, mass moves mass, the heavier we get, the more we can push our maximum strength, even if all we're gaining is fat. And a lot of people think, well, if I just dirty bulk, if I go all in and just a 30% surplus, my lifts are going up, my deadlift, my squat, everything's going up. I've got to be building extra muscle tissue to support that, right? And the answer still seems to be no, in which case, not why not, but why are the lifts continuing to go up? Because this study did show a benefit for maximal strength in the quote unquote dirty bulking group.
Yes, on an absolute basis.
On
yes.
Absolute, exact, not relative. And that's key, which then there's something at play. I believe it has to do with cross-sectional area and leverages and things like that. Do you know like the subtleties behind why the maximal strength continues going up with weight?
Not enough to say it publicly. Okay. I'm sure some biomechanists would say I'm all wrong, but I will say my knowledge is what you said. The more mass you have, the more mass you're going to be able to move. And the other thing is when we look at all of the overfeeding studies, when they overfeed subjects by 1,000 calories a day or 500 calories a day for weeks on end, they gain significant amounts of body weight. And some of that is lean tissue. So there's people aren't gaining pure body fat. They are gaining lean tissue, even without lifting. So I'm not, if somebody is a larger person or they gain weight, they are going to gain some lean tissue and they will be stronger. And some of that is maybe because of the lean tissue they gain. But other thing, like what you were saying earlier, is they have more mass. They're going to be able to exert a greater force on an external object because they have a larger mass.
Yeah, and if we take it to the extreme, sumo wrestlers, right? We know that they have tons of muscle mass. It's this, I guess, the old school powerlifting thought of why don't I just gain 150 pounds and get the, not the relative strength increase to body weight, but just the absolute strength. And then when I cut, I'm going to have way more muscle than somebody who did it the sort of, you know, the 10% surplus way. But I don't think it computes that way, right? Is that correct? Or is there a benefit to that?
Yeah. So not, I don't know the rules of powerlifting, but I believe it's always a relative strength. Like they convert it to a Wilkes score. But I'd have to text my buddy Lane Norton. He can tell us 3 hours.
Get him on the show. Okay, a couple more questions then. Let's go the other direction. Lean gaining. Everybody loves the idea of lean gaining, main gaining, gaintaining, right? All the buzzwords of, okay, instead of the 10% surplus, I'm going to go with the 5% or I'm going to go with 2%, you know, just above that maintenance, which, you know, my take on that is always, okay, if you want to spend years and years building muscle, you could do that. Is there a disadvantage from a relative standpoint in doing that? Or is it just a time, like you're just dilating the amount of time? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you. 2%, I mean, that's not even outside the rounding errors of the rice that I'm measuring. So 2% is probably not enough to move any tangible needle. 5%, probably, yes. That would actually, I would feel like, okay, you actually are increasing your calories. But anything less than a 5% increment, I would say unless you're weighing your lettuce and your rice kernels, I wouldn't bother with 2%. So I don't think very few people are going to be that precise.
Yeah, good point. From a practical standpoint, you would only know in hindsight if you just over months, like, seen the average weight trend go in that direction, but then it's too late. You've already gone past the point we made those decisions. And then what about women versus men? This study was this on men?
Yes, trained men?
Yeah.
All of the studies that I'm aware of. And in fact, I don't know if women would sign up for a bulk.
Yeah, I was going to say they don't want to gain weight for a study.
Yeah. Maybe I'm sure there's some, but you would not in one geographical location. I think you'd have a hard time recruiting. And sadly, there's no trouble recruiting females for fat loss studies. It's good for those that need to lose body fat, but I think we're both aware a lot of women think they should. And it's like, no, you're lean. It's unfortunate that you have whatever pressure that makes you have to lose,
for sure.
Feel like you want to lose more.
All right. In the interest of time, I wanted to touch one more topic, and that was the anti-anabolic effects of the keto diet study, the issue 18 study 2, mm-hmm. effects of a ketogenic diet on body composition and strength in trained women. Speaking of, there's a fat loss study.
There we go.
Vargas Molina, 2020, where they compared a keto diet versus a high carb diet in resistance trained women. The keto diet group lost more body fat, but gained less muscle mass. The caveat there is they also ate on average 270 calories less, but then you note that that could just be a result of the higher satiety of the diet. And then the higher carb group gained muscle mass and strength. So I have a whole bunch of notes here, but let's just jump in for time, you know, and talk to me about your thoughts. Like, is keto recommended for anyone outside of medical conditions, to be honest, for if you care about building muscle?
So it is not the ideal diet if your primary goal is to build muscle. That study was a microcosm of other studies in males. Now, this study was in females, but we have the same data in males. We have cellular data where a ketogenic diet suppresses anabolic signaling in skeletal muscle. So if the goal is to build as much muscle as possible, it is not the best diet choice. On the flip side, if your primary goal is to lose body fat, the ketogenic diet has a lot of utility and value for the people who can follow it, for expressly the reason that you suggested earlier. There is no other diet that suppresses appetite like a ketogenic diet. It's the best diet for making you have less hunger. So if it's a fat loss, I would put this on the table for clients. Like, hey, what do you think about this? You want to lose body fat? Here's an approach that would maybe help you with this. Again, if somebody wants to gain muscle, it's not the best choice. But then, even then, I would say, you're not going to gain as much. You're not going to optimize muscle. But do you like the ketogenic diet? Yes. Yeah, I like it. Okay. Do you have any goals to step on Mr. or Miss Olympia stage? No. Okay. Then maybe this is still a diet for you to gain muscle, but you're just not going to gain as much as you could with this diet. Because again, there's a little blunting of anabolic signaling. And we also have a study in males where it suppressed testosterone as well.
Yeah, right. And in this study, there was, you mentioned that. That was from a distance study, sorry.
Yep.
And you also said, suppression of muscle protein synthesis, which is what we're talking about here. Is keto really more satiating, or is it keto compared to an uninhibited diet more satiating? I say it like that because my clients, they know, you know, eat a lot of fiber, nutrient dense foods, high satiety foods, you know, potatoes and apples and oranges are in there. If you're actually paying attention to satiety, is it more satiating?
I'll say maybe not if you're controlling for fiber and if you're controlling for protein. So where that statement comes from is when you look at all of the studies where they didn't control for anything, ketogenic diet sometimes or many times will lose more body weight. And then the false narrative is, oh, see, it's better. It's like, no, they ate significantly less calories. So there is some evidence to suggest that ketones help suppress or lower appetite. So in that case, it would be unique. But how much would that happen if calories and protein is controlled and fiber? Maybe not as much.
Right. Yeah. And in a fat loss phase that gets fairly either drawn out or aggressive, the fat or the carbs end up being somewhat low anyway, I would say. Maybe not keto low, though, because keto, I guess we're defining as like maybe 50 or 30 grams, you know, something down in that range. Okay, cool. I know you got to go. So is there any last thing you want to mention? Otherwise, we can tell people where to find your stuff and I'll make sure to throw those in the show notes.
No, but I would love to have you contribute to my research review in the future. So hopefully you'll take me up on that offer. You're a scientist, and I think you gave me some background of your past education, et cetera, et cetera. So, but thank you so much for having me on again and letting me talk about the things that I love to talk about.
Thank you so much, Bill. And on the record, I will definitely be, I would love to contribute to your review because I'm a passionate follower of it myself, as well as a lot of our listeners. So thank you again. I'm going to, you know, throw all this information, the review in there as well, how people can find you on IG, and we're going to be in touch. So enjoy the rest of your day and thanks for coming on.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Wits and Weights. If you found value in today's episode and know someone else who's looking to level up their wits or weights, please take a moment to share this episode with them and make sure to hit the follow button in your podcast platform right now to catch the next episode. Until then, stay strong. Hey, before you go, I want to let you know about a free resource I have. They are free guides on everything from fat loss to eating out to building muscle to managing hunger to figuring out the best macros for you and more being added all the time. You want to get the most out of these podcasts and your time to look and feel your best, and these free guides will give you a quick and easy way to know what to do. If you want to get your hands on these completely free guides, you can head over to witsandweights.com/free. That's witsandweights.com/free to get your free guides and level up your results today.